From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! Breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency, the battle for New York.
For more than 20 years, on every one of the great issues of freedom and security, John Kerry has been more wrong, more weak, and more wobbly than any other national figure.
Democratic Senator Zell Miller delivers the keynote address at the Republican convention. We'll take a look at who the Georgia senator is and why he broke ranks with his party to endorse George Bush. And Vice President Dick Cheney accepts his party's nomination, blasting John Kerry.
Senator Kerry has disagreed with many of his fellow Democrats, but Senator Kerry's liveliest disagreement is with himself.
And phone calls from jail. Detained protesters describe the condition of Pier 57, the temporary holding facility in New York that's being described as Guantanamo on the Hudson.
There are chemical warning signs all over this place that we're being held. A lot of people are forming rashes on their skin from the floor, from whatever it is that is on it.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency, the battle for New York. I'm Amy Goodman. At the Republican National Convention last night, Democratic Senator Zell Miller and Vice President Dick Cheney lashed out at John Kerry, accusing him of being unfit to be president. Cheney said for 20 years, Kerry has repeatedly made the wrong call on major national security issues. Miller attacked not just Kerry, but his own Democratic Party. He said the party's manic obsession with bringing down Bush is tearing apart the country and making it weaker. In news from the streets of New York, police are now saying they arrested around 1,100 people on Tuesday during mass direct action protests. This brings the total arrested to over 1,800 over the past week. By comparison, about 600 people were arrested during the historic 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. Yesterday, a dozen members of ACT UP New York were arrested inside Madison Square Garden after they disrupted a presentation by White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card. Two members of Code Pink were later arrested during Vice President Dick Cheney's speech. The day began when demonstrators formed a three-mile long symbolic unemployment line that stretched from Wall Street to Madison Square Garden. More protests are scheduled for today to coincide with President Bush's acceptance of the party's nomination. United for Peace and Justice has called for an 8 p.m. demonstration in Union Square. Meanwhile, President Bush arrived in New York last night and watched the convention with firefighters in an Italian-American community center in Queens. He also accepted the endorsement of the Uniform Firefighters Association of Greater New York. The nation's largest firefighter union, the International Association of Firefighters, has endorsed John Kerry. In Iraq, U.S. forces killed up to 20 Iraqis in a bombing raid in a residential area of Fallujah. At least three children were killed in the attack. The Pentagon claimed the strike targeted two safe houses of wanted members of the Iraqi resistance. Israel's deputy defense minister warned today Israel should consider attacking targets in Syria in response to a suicide bus bombing that killed 16. This, according to a report in Haaretz, the Israeli government has attempted to link Tuesday's bombing to Hamas leaders living in Syria. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the U.S. and France put forward a Security Council resolution yesterday demanding 20,000 Syrian troops immediately withdraw from Lebanon and for Syria not to meddle in upcoming elections in Lebanon. The resolution threatens unspecified, quote, additional measures against Syria if it doesn't comply. The Washington Post reporting that the FBI has been investigating whether AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, helped to illegally pass on highly classified intelligence from the National Security Agency to the Israeli government. According to the Washington Post, the FBI has been investigating AIPAC for 2 years, and that the probe extends well beyond the role of the Pentagon analyst Larry Franklin. Franklin's the Pentagon's top Iran analyst and is suspected of spying for Israel. In Colorado, a judge has dismissed the rape charge against basketball star Kobe Bryant after prosecutors said the woman who alleged she had been raped would not testify against the basketball star. In Florida, nearly 500,000 people have been ordered to evacuate their homes ahead of Hurricane Frances. This comes just week after the devastating Hurricane Charley. In campaign news, President Bush's campaign filed a lawsuit yesterday to force five liberal organizations to stop running TV commercials. The Bush camp claims the so-called 527 groups are illegally coordinating their efforts with Kerry's campaign. The groups include MoveOn.org, Media Fund, and America Coming Together. The New York Times is reporting Warner Brothers has decided not to distribute director David O. Russell's new anti-war documentary when it re-releases his 1999 Gulf War movie Three Kings this fall. The studio said the anti-war documentary is, quote, totally inappropriate for a political season. It features interviews with Iraqi refugees and veterans of the current war in Iraq.
I've been having a hard time, a hard time. I've been having a hard, old, hard time. Every day's just the same, naughty nickel to my name. I've been having a hard time and a hard time. Brothers are having a hard time, a hard time. Brothers having a hard time.
Woody Guthrie, Hard Times, here on Democracy Now!, Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency, The Battle for New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Good day. Protests against the Republican convention continued yesterday throughout New York as Democratic Senator Zell Miller delivered the convention's keynote address and Vice President Dick Cheney accepted his party's nomination to run for a second term. Early in the day, AIDS activists from ACT UP breached the Madison Square Garden Convention Hall and briefly interrupted a speech by White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card to the young Republicans, including Bush's twin daughters. Outside, 5,000 people protesting high job losses formed a single silent file unemployment line that stretched for 3 miles from Wall Street to 31st Street, just shy of the convention center. In the afternoon, tens of thousands of New York City union members gathered for 2 hours in a raucous rally two blocks from Madison Square Garden that was protesting the Bush administration's anti-labor policies.
Later in the day, some 2,000 people staged a march on the media to protest what they say is uncritical coverage of the Bush administration by the mainstream press. Other major protests included a women's rights demonstration and a protest against Coca-Cola. The police arrested 19 people, bringing the total of those detained so far during 7 days of relentless convention-related protests to more than 1,700, a record for a political convention. Hundreds of people protested the conditions under which those arrested are being held before going to court, saying the site is contaminated with oil and asbestos. Pier 57, where they are being held, is a three-story block-long pier that has been converted to a holding pen.
Yesterday morning, we received a call from one of the protesters being held at Pier 57 who had smuggled a phone inside. Detainees passed the phone to each other and described the conditions of the holding facility. Democracy Now! Producer Mike Burke took the call and spoke with the detained protesters. Listen closely. After the first caller passes the phone, you can hear a prisoner in the background calling out for help and medical assistance.
My name is Emily. I was arrested yesterday off of Union Square East, on East 15th Street, in between Union Square East and Irvine. I was on the sidewalk, and I was never told that I would be arrested. I was just on the sidewalk, and no one ever read me my rights. They just took us all away. They trapped us and took us all into buses. We've been in jail for over 13 hours right now. In our first 9 hours, the only food we received was an apple. In our first 4 hours here, we weren't allowed to go to the bathroom or get water. So none of us were read our rights. We haven't been able to talk to any lawyers. A lot of people here that were arrested without even protesting, they were just happened to be on sidewalk where everyone that was on that block was arrested. And there are chemical warning signs all over this place that we're being held. A lot of people are forming rashes on their skin from the floor, from whatever it is that is on it. And I'm going to pass this on to someone else who has another story.
My name is Althea, and I'm a New York City public school teacher. I was out on Union Square on 16th Street between Irving and Union Square, just walking, trying to enjoy the tax-free day, and I got swept up in a demonstration. I wasn't a part of the demonstration, and I was arrested. I was arrested about 8 p.m., handcuffed, and we've been sitting in Chelsea Piers, very crowded conditions. Right now, some people are experiencing toxic reaction to the environment, itching in their skin, and we're very crowded. We have been given water and a sandwich, but they have not been giving us any information, and we've just been sitting here really penned in.
Have you been able to communicate to any of your family or friends about your situation?
No, I haven't. I've been asking my arresting officer, when can I make a phone call, and no one knows where I am. Basically, I feel like I've been disappeared. Nobody knows in my family that I've been arrested. And I was out by myself shopping, so, you know, there's no one to that allowed me to contact anyone.
Hi, this is Deepa Majumdar. I'm calling also from here's the arrestage facility. Basically, I was just a standby, and I was walking on the sidewalk, and there was a march going on. They cordoned off the whole street and just arrested all of us. And when I tried to explain that I was just walking by, I had a receipt from a store that I had bought something from on that street. They did not pay any attention. And here we are sitting in this almost a human rights abuse condition. So many of us are cold, we are freezing, some of us need medical attention. Nobody's telling us what to do, nobody's listening to us, nobody's giving us any timeline, any idea of when we might get out. They've always been saying next 2 hours, 2 hours. It's been more than 12 hours now.
Could you describe what you were doing just before you were arrested?
What was I doing?
Yes.
Basically, I was walking on the sidewalk. I didn't even know that there were police. And the march was going on. And all of a sudden, the street basically just gets cordoned off. And we cannot move. So before I was arrested, I was just standing still because that's all we could really do. And then they just started putting handcuffs on people. They didn't tell us, please leave, otherwise we'll arrest you. They gave us no warning. They gave us no chance to leave. They just basically closed up the street, put handcuffs, and took us. And they did not listen to anybody. They did not listen to even the pure reason. They just put us all And we thought we would, you know, basically get out in a couple of hours if we have done nothing. But here we are 12 hours later, and they basically, they almost ridicule us. They're ridiculous if you try to complain. I mean, and you know, and the conditions here are atrocious. You have to see them to believe. It's dirty, it's smelly, it's filthy. We don't have a blanket. We don't have something to sit on. We're sitting on the floor. There's dirt on the floor. There's oil on the floor. There's chemicals around us. It's smelling bad. I mean, I can go on and on. It's atrocious.
Could you describe what kind of room you're in? It sounds like there are many, many people in the same room.
We are like over 100 people in a very small room. It's surrounded by fence, and we are like, it's almost like rats packed into a hole. I mean, we have, there's nothing, there's just a floor, which is very dirty, which is a lot of oil and all dust in it. I mean, all our clothes are dirty, our hands are dirty. We had to eat an apple with our extremely dirty hands because we have no tissue paper, nothing to clean our hands with. And we're just basically packed. Nobody can sit down. Nobody, they don't even give us a plastic bag to sit on. They don't even have anything to lie down on. We just have to lie on a hard floor, basically. And there's not enough space for even everybody to lie down because we have to sit so close together. It's cramped. And it was freezing before. And no, when people were actually coughing, they were getting cold, and nobody paid any attention. Nobody gave them even a blanket. Nobody gave them even a plastic bag to cover themselves with.
My name's Janet, and I was arrested last night. I was actually on the sidewalk. We were having a party in the street. We were dancing a little bit, and then the cops started to pen us in, so we moved on to the sidewalk, and there was a lot of us crammed into a small space. They did not give us an order of dispersal. Instead, they just smashed us all together, and they started, at first they were picking people out and smashing their heads on the sidewalk. I couldn't really get a good look of that because I was in the back being, like, slammed between a wall and a bunch of people. And they slowly, slowly, slowly broke us off and put us on the buses. We're on the buses for a really long time. Now we're in a holding cell. It's been probably more than 12 hours. It's been about 13 hours, I think. They just told me when I got medical attention that they arrested 1,100 people last night, and we're all still in here. It's totally nasty. The floor is greasy. There's signs everywhere saying we should be wearing masks and goggles, and I have this really bad rash on my hand. It's getting worse and worse. It feels like I just stuck my hand in an oven. It burns so bad, and it's, my arms are tingling, and my other hand is getting it too. I spent a really long time trying to let them get me out of here so I could at least wash my hands and put some ice on it. Finally, my arresting officer came, and she took me over there, and there's a doctor and a nurse in this office, and they didn't have a sink for me to wash my hands, but they let me pour saline solution over my hand into a garbage can and then rub some Purell hand sanitizer on my hands. My hands are so black and dirty from how gross it is in here that I couldn't even get them clean. And then they gave me a wet tissue to put on it. So basically, they couldn't really do anything for me. They told me to put some hydrocortisone cream on it, which isn't very helpful because I'm in here. And now I'm just sitting back in this cell with everybody else. They're not really telling us what's going on. It seems like we're going to be in here for a really long time.
Phone calls from jail. Voices of protesters detained inside Pier 57. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has denied the city's operating what some have called Guantanamo on the Hudson, defended the use of the pier garage, saying, quote, it's not supposed to be Club Med. Last night, a judge ordered protesters who'd been held for 24 hours released with desk appearance tickets if they're not charged with serious crimes. Before midnight, some protesters started emerging from 100 Center Street around the block from our firehouse studio. Some 200 supporters greeted them with cheers, offering them food and medical treatment. Despite the judge's orders, a large number of protesters remain imprisoned. There is a hearing set at 10 a.m. Simone Levine is with us. She is lead organizer of the National Lawyers Guild campaign to protect the rights of prisoners during the Republican National Convention. Thanks for coming in with no sleep. But what is happening here? How many people do you understand remain detained?
Well, right now, Amy, we actually have a number of 900 people who are still detained.
Last night I was at the Republican convention. As people were leaving, I was talking to delegates, and I asked if they were aware of the protests. And one woman said yes, and I said, are you aware that there have been over 1,500 arrests? For a moment, they couldn't talk. They were completely shocked.
Well, it's good to know that they're actually listening. It's good to know that they actually, you know, somebody is giving them the news.
Well, that was how they were learning, but they certainly right. hadn't known it from inside the Republican convention, as most New Yorkers don't, because not very much is being talked about. Why are they being held in this way? Is this common practice?
Well, I don't think that it's common practice for arrests to be held as long as they have been held. I mean, we have people that have now been detained for more than 36 hours. What the law says is that somebody cannot be held past 24 hours, barring some kind of emergency situation. And that's exactly what we were arguing yesterday in court, that this is not an emergency situation. The number of arrests that they have made over the last 24-hour period is not more arrests than they would make in a normal day in New York City, so they should be able to process these arrests.
But they have those arrests as well.
No, they don't, because what has happened is they've taken all the police out of the outlying boroughs, out of the Bronx, out of Brooklyn, out of Queens, and they put them in Manhattan in order to work on the protests alone, so they don't have the other
There's only a skeleton
arrests.
Police force anywhere else in the city. But I'd like to ask you, I spoke to a judge yesterday who told me, it was in arraignment court, and told me that the one big problem that they're having is that the all these arrests that are being processed, obviously, everyone is fingerprinted, and their fingerprints are sent to Albany, but they say that up in Albany, there's no additional staff, so the hundreds and hundreds of fingerprints are being backed up there. It almost seems like the city, which claims to have prepared for everything, but dealing with the massive arrests, and whether this is deliberate or whether this was a sort of unplanned is not clear, but you suspect that there may have been some deliberate attempt to slow the process down and keep people in jail.
I don't know if I would say it was deliberate, but I think that one thing that I'm definitely secure in saying is that the police department has known for over a year that they are going to be having the Republican National Convention here. They have said for over 6 months that they themselves expect 1,000 arrests a day. They decided to set out a completely separate facility to detain people in. And they decide to set up their own central booking system. They go by their own rules, and they set up their own special facilities. That being said, they provided a facility, a detention facility, which was slick with oil, which is causing people to have chemical burns at this point. It used to be a bus depot, and they have a holding facility in which we've received calls from demonstrators that they've been held in for 20 and 30 hours, and nothing has been happening whatsoever. And the other thing that I would just mention as to fingerprints is that the police department obviously has jurisdiction to give people desk appearance tickets and summonses without fingerprints, without fingerprinting them.
We're talking to Simona Levine. She's lead organizer for the National Lawyers Guild campaign to protect the rights of protesters during the Republican National Convention. We'll be back with her, then we'll go to some of the speeches on the floor of the Republican National Convention and ask who is Zell Miller, the Democratic Senator of Georgia, who is endorsing the Republican presidential candidate George Bush and Republican President George Bush. Also, we'll hear Dick Cheney's speech, his acceptance speech of the nomination for vice president, and talk about his record as well. Stay with us.
He that built all the bombs, he that hide behind the walls, he that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but built to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. like Judas of old. You lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe.
Masters of War, Bob Dylan here on Democracy Now!, Breaking with Convention, War, Peace in the Presidency, The Battle for New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Yes, I'd like to ask you, Simone. The New York Times today has an article talking about the enormous success of the police department and Mayor Bloomberg in affecting a preemptive strike policy on these protests to prevent them from getting to Madison Square Garden. But my colleagues in the corporate press, are many of them who've been out on the streets, are very, very upset. They're upset about the police tactics, and they're upset about the fact that many of their stories are not really getting in the papers or on TV. One Daily News reporter told me the story yesterday that on Tuesday he attended a protest at the Hummer dealership on 11th Avenue on the west side. 15 reporters showed up, 40 police, and only one protester showed up at this rally. One young woman who was by herself picketing in front of the Hummer dealership. The police supervisor approached her and said, you are blocking traffic. I'm giving you a warning or you're going to be arrested. And she was stunned. The reporters were stunned because she was the only protester in front of the dealership. And she said, what do you mean? I'm not blocking anybody's traffic. And the police supervisor said, that's it. You had your time. Cuff her. And they carted her away. And the reporter wrote a story which didn't make our paper. And in fact, I think there was only a mention in Newsday of it. So there's a problem here in terms of this preemptive strike policy by the police department and also in terms of how the media are covering it.
Well, I would just start off by saying that to the one protester who was arrested outside of the Hummer dealership, that you have to be congregating with others in order to be guilty of disorderly conduct. She was clearly not congregating with anybody, just being by herself there.
Maybe with the riot police?
Maybe with the riot police. The other thing that I was going to mention is I've actually gotten a lot of comments from press who have been extremely upset over this issue as well, mostly because we've gotten quite a number of phone calls to our legal office from press who've been arrested themselves, who have had NYPD-issued press cards, have showed the NYPD press cards to the police and have still been arrested, and they themselves are still in the holding facility.
Well, I heard an inspector, one of the people in charge over at Times Square, as they moved in on a bunch of protesters, often not warning them in advance. It's a kind of zap attack. They move in behind them as they're walking, and there are some undercover in front of them, and ones come up on the on motorcycles on the side, so you are totally hemmed in. And they just arrest you. And the inspector said to the police around him, if they stop, if they ask questions, cuff them.
I've heard the same reports, and people have really been caught between police who do come in from the back and also from the front, and they have nowhere to go. And that's the way a lot of the press, I believe, on Tuesday had also gotten trapped by the police.
What's happening today? What's this writ of habeas corpus? Are these protesters going to be out? Are they going to keep them through George Bush's speech tonight?
Well, we have we filed two writs last night. The Legal Aid Society filed one writ. The Legal Aid Society is the major public defenders group here in New York City, who are the only unionized public defenders group in New York City. And they filed one last night. It was in front of Judge Cataldo. And Judge Cataldo had said that everybody that is charged with infractions or violations like disorderly conduct should be up by 1 o'clock last night in the morning, and everybody charged with misdemeanors or felonies should be up before 9 o'clock in the morning. My understanding was that there is going to be re-argument this morning on Judge Cataldo's writ. It's at 60 Center Street, and we're asking people to get there early at 9 o'clock in the morning. It's supposed to be in room 130. There was also a second writ taken last night by members of the National Lawyers Guild, and that was in front of Judge, I believe it was Judge Goodman, is Judge Emily Goodman, and that writ was to allow access to clients by their attorneys, so attorneys could get access to their clients. We then went down to corrections to go try to meet with our clients. Particularly, we have about 40 outstanding cases of extreme medical urgency that have not been documented, have not been attended to by the NYPD, and corrections did not allow us in despite the fact that we had a judicial order.
Simone Levine, I want to thank you for being with us, lead organizer of the National Lawyers Guild campaign to protect rights of protesters. Again, the figures, it looks like about 1,800 people have been arrested. And Simone, that number one more time of how many remain imprisoned.
900 people, Amy, still remain inside, despite the fact that now we have two judicial orders to the contrary.
And Pier 57, I was speaking with a union organizer last night at TWU, because this was an old depot that they're being put in at Pier 57. He was describing the fire that happened there 10 years ago in 1994, talked about the asbestos that is there and that they could not get the asbestos out. It hasn't been used as a facility for human beings to be in for quite a while, until this point now, where more than 1,000 protesters have been detained. We will keep folks updated.
The last thing I was just going to say, Amy, is that we are telling people who've been released from jail that they must bag their clothing, seal their clothing, put a label on when they were released and when they were arrested, that there will be follow-up lawsuits.
Well, we're going to turn now from what's been happening in the streets to the convention floor. The Republican National Convention taking place this week at Madison Square Garden. Juan?
Well, President Bush arrived in New York last night, where he joined firefighters in Queens in a scene that was briefly beamed into the convention hall, and to also to accept the endorsement of leaders of the city's main firefighters union, the Uniform Firefighters Association. Across the river, Vice President Dick Cheney accepted his party's nomination, and Democratic Senator Zell Miller delivered the keynote address on the third day of the Republican convention. The theme for the convention's penultimate night was Land of Opportunity, but both headline speakers yesterday used their time to blast Democratic opponent John Kerry, depicting him as a weak and indecisive leader.
Senator Zell Miller, Democrat of Georgia, abandoned his party earlier this year to give the Republican keynote address. 12 years ago, he delivered the Democratic keynote address in the same hall at the 1992 convention that nominated Bill Clinton. Other speakers of the night included Labor Secretary Elaine Chao, Michael Reagan, son of the late President Ronald Reagan. The president's other son, Ron Reagan, spoke at the Democratic convention in Boston in July. But it was Senator Miller and Vice President Cheney who were the stars of the night. We begin with Zell Miller.
Never in the history of the world has any soldier sacrificed more for the freedom and liberty of total strangers than the American soldier. And our soldiers don't just give freedom abroad, they preserve it for us here at home. For it has been said so truthfully that it is the soldier, not the reporter, who has given us the freedom of the press. It is the soldier, not the poet, who has given us freedom of speech. It is the soldier, not the agitator, who has given us the freedom to protest. It is the soldier who salutes the flag, serves beneath the flag, whose coffin is draped by the flag, who gives that protester the freedom he abuses to burn that flag. No one should dare to even think about being the commander-in-chief of this country if he doesn't believe with all his heart that our soldiers are liberators abroad and defenders of freedom at home. But don't waste your breath telling that to the leaders of my party today. In their warped way of thinking, America is the problem, not the solution. They don't believe there's any real danger in the world except that which America brings upon itself through our clumsy and misguided foreign policy. It is not their patriotism, it is their judgment that has been so sorely lacking. They claimed Carter's pacifism would lead to peace. They were wrong. They claimed Reagan's defense buildup would lead to war. They were wrong. And no pair has been more wrong, more loudly, more often than the two senators from Massachusetts, Ted Kennedy and John Kerry. Together, Kennedy and Kerry have opposed the very weapon systems that won the Cold War and that are now winning the war on terror. Listing all the weapon systems that Senator Kerry tried his best to shut down sounds like an auctioneer selling off our national security. But Americans need to know the facts. The B-1 bomber that Senator Kerry opposed dropped 40% of the bombs in the first 6 months of enduring freedom. The B-2 bomber that Senator Kerry opposed delivered airstrikes against the Taliban in Afghanistan and Hussein's command post in Iraq. The F-14A Tomcats that Senator Kerry opposed shot down Gaddafi's Libyan MiGs over the Gulf of Sidra. The modernized F-14D that Senator Kerry opposed delivered missile strikes against Tora Bora. The Apache helicopter that Senator Kerry opposed took out those Republican guard tanks in Kuwait in the Gulf War. The F-15 Eagles that Senator Kerry opposed flew cover over our nation's capital and this very city after 9/11. I could go on and on and on against the Patriot missile that shot down Saddam Hussein's Scud missiles over Israel, against the Aegis air defense cruiser, against the Strategic Defense Initiative, against the Trident missile, against. This is the man who wants to be the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Armed Forces. U.S. Forces armed with what? Spitballs? Folks can tell you much more about a man than 20 weeks of campaign rhetoric. Campaign talk tells people who you want them to think you are. How you vote tells people who you really are deep inside. Senator Kerry has made it clear that he would use military force only if approved by the United Nations. Kerry would let Paris decide when America needs defending. I want Bush to decide. John Kerry, who says he doesn't like outsourcing, wants to outsource our national security. That's the most dangerous outsourcing of all. This politician wants to be leader of the free world, free for how long? For more than 20 years, on every one of the great issues of freedom and security, John Kerry has been more wrong, more weak, and more wobbly than any other national figure. As a war protester, Kerry blamed our military. As a senator, he voted to weaken our military. And nothing shows that more sadly and more clearly than his vote this year to deny protective armor for our troops in harm's way, far away.
Georgia Senator Zell Miller endorsing President George Bush. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll look at the life of Zell Miller, specifically why he changed his endorsement, why he has moved toward the Republican Party, and then we'll talk about Dick Cheney. Stay with us. Impressions, people get ready. Here on Democracy Now!, Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency, The Battle for New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Let's talk briefly about Georgia Senator Zell Miller, gave the keynote address last night at the Republican National Convention. John Sugg on the line with us from Georgia, Atlanta, senior editor of Creative Loafing, the Atlanta-based alternative weekly. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, glad to be here.
Nice to talk to you again, John. Tell us who Senator Miller is.
Well, I think it's important to realize where Zell got his start and why he earned the name Zigzag. He was his start in politics began as chief of staff for Governor Lester Maddox. Lester Maddox was one of Georgia's most famous racists and segregationists, and that's how Zell began his career. When it was expedient to be a racist and a segregationist, that's what he was. A few years later, when he saw the tide changing, he suddenly championed integration. And throughout his career, you've had that same, opportunistic shift for whatever worked. And that's how he earned the name Zigzag. Now, you listened to that speech last night. I mean, I just want to make one comment. You know, the comment about demonstrators and the military. You know, I mean, Zell should know better than what he said. The military is a tool that can be used for good or evil. We've seen the best and the worst right in Iraq, as we saw it in Vietnam. The demonstrators, he totally omits the role of protest and dissent when he says, "What about the civil rights movement?" You know, it wasn't our military that won the civil rights movement. It was people on the streets. And a change in hearts and attitudes in America. So, you know, Zell joins, you know, a long list of treacherous people who have tried to capitalize on America that, I guess, begins with Benedict Arnold.
But doesn't the Democratic Party, in essence, by having these blue dog Democrats in its midst, create the possibility for these kinds of turns at critical junctures in American politics?
Well, I don't defend the Democratic Party. I mean, you know, both parties, you know, have weird wings, you know, out there. The Republicans right now are trying to put forward this moderate face, the people that they're bringing up on stage and everything. Yet we know that the people at the controls of the Republican Party are, you know, the radicals, you know, beginning with, I was listening to Phyllis Schlafly last night, you know, and stuff, and you listen to the real kooky ones out there, and they're the ones that are running things. You know, the Democrats made a devil's alliance years ago when it included the Dixiecrats in its umbrella, and I think that, I guess you could say that they're still paying the price for embracing, you know, Southern racist by having listening to Zell Miller last night. But you know, Zell's true character, who he was. He was interviewed on CNN after the speech. And, you know, Wolf Blitzer and they were trying to toss him softballs, okay? And he was so unprepared to answer questions about the different weapon systems. Those are the same weapon systems that Dick Cheney opposed when he was defense secretary. And so Zell pulls a paper out of his jacket pocket and says, "I have a list. I have a list." And of course, where have we heard that before? You know, that sounds the I thought that he was channeling Joe McCarthy there for a moment. You know, but.
Well, John Sugg, we want to thank you for being with us. We're going to turn now to Dick Cheney and his major address last night, acceptance of the nomination for vice president a second time. John Sugg, senior editor at Creative Loafing in Atlanta. Yes, Dick Cheney spoke last night, his speech broadcast in primetime, giving Americans their closest look in years at a key figure in the Bush administration who normally shuns the limelight. Vice President Cheney took to the podium to give the final address of the night.
The president's opponent is an experienced senator. He speaks often of his service in Vietnam, and we honor him for it. But there is also a record of more than three decades since. And on the question of America's role in the world, the differences between Senator Kerry and President Bush are the sharpest, and the stakes for the country are the highest. History has shown that a strong and purposeful America is vital to preserving freedom and keeping us safe. Yet time and again, Senator Kerry has made the wrong call on national security. Senator Kerry began his political career by saying he would like to see our troops deployed only at the directive of the United Nations. During the 1980s, Senator Kerry opposed Ronald Reagan's major defense initiatives that brought victory in the Cold War. And in 1991, when Saddam Hussein occupied Kuwait and stood poised to dominate the Persian Gulf, Senator Kerry voted against Operation Desert Storm. Even in this post-9/11 period, Senator Kerry doesn't appear to understand how the world has changed. He talks about leading a more sensitive war on terror, as though Al-Qaeda will be impressed with our softer side. He declared at the Democratic Convention that he will forcefully defend America after we have been attacked. My fellow Americans, we have already been attacked. Faced with an enemy who seeks the deadliest of weapons to use against us, and we cannot wait until the next attack. We must do everything we can to prevent it, and that includes the use of military force. Senator Kerry denounces American action when other countries don't approve, as if the whole object of our foreign policy were to please a few persistent critics. But in fact, the global war on terror, as in Afghanistan and Iraq, President Bush has brought many allies to our side. But as the President has made very clear, there is a difference between leading a coalition of many nations and submitting to the objections of a few. George W. Bush will never seek a permission slip to defend the American people.
Vice President Dick Cheney speaking last night, accepting the nomination for vice president for a second term, delivering perhaps the convention's most stinging assault on Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry. We're joined in the studio by two people who have followed Dick Cheney's career and the companies he's been affiliated with. We're joined by the senior editor of the Capital Times, as well as Nation magazine reporter, John Nichols. He has a new book, which is called Dick, the Man Who Is the President.
Dick, and who is president.
Prothap Chatterjee, managing director of CorpWatch.org, working with us this week at Democracy Now! Juan.
Well, John, your reaction to Vice President Cheney's speech, and tell us a little bit about him and, and what you found in your research on your book.
Well, my first reaction to Vice President Cheney's speech actually fits with Zell Miller as well. This is probably the last time in our lifetimes that we will see two speakers, one after another, the first of whom began his career as an American segregationist, opposing integration in the South, the second of whom highlighted his career in Congress as being one of the few people who voted consistently to keep Nelson Mandela in jail. Really a remarkable signal, and in most countries in the world, people with that sort of track record wouldn't be allowed anywhere near the amount of power that these gentlemen have. But Dick Cheney's speech was a classic Dick Cheney speech. I mean, there was always the joke of, you know, well, maybe you should watch him closely because maybe this time the lizard will actually come out when he opens his mouth. But the reality is that he went back to his core themes, and it's important to note those. He was mostly talking about foreign policy. He's obsessed with foreign policy. And his two big messages were there would be no break from unilateralism. This country will continue to be hardcore committed to a unilateral vision of how it operates in the world. No permission slips from any other countries. And two, a passionate defense of presidential war making. And it's important to remember, this is the guy who was central to the defense of Ronald Reagan during the Iran-Contra process. He's the one who wrote the dissenting opinion that essentially shot down any possibility of an impeachment of Ronald Reagan for Iran-Contra. Dick Cheney has been at the core of some of the darkest activities in this country over the last 40 years, a man who began in the Nixon White House, key player in the Ford White House, went to Congress and was Reagan's key defender on the far right, somebody that Newt Gingrich said is much more conservative than me, someone who, when the National Journal checked the voting record, found he was a little to the right of Jesse Helms. This is our vice president, and people ought to watch him closely, because George Bush will give a compassionate conservative speech tonight, but if you want to see what's going to happen in the next 4 years, go back and read what Cheney said. Listen to what Cheney said last night, because that's the blueprint for the next 4 years. And note that just as in 2000, he mentioned countries that the United States might have to deal with, in this case, Iran and North Korea.
John, just a quick question. You were at the youth convention yesterday, the Republican youth convention with the twins. The
I wasn't actually attending the convention. I was.
Were covering it, and protesters came in from ACT UP. What actually happened to them?
Well, it's an interesting thing. They got into the hall, and you know, I think they just signed up and you know got in. They were wearing street clothes. Right when Andy Card spoke, their goal was to get a message through directly
the
to someone in
staff.
The administration. So when, after Jenna and Barbara Bush introduced Andy Card, they jumped up on their chairs, pulled off their street shirts, had white T-shirts saying Bush lies, held up small signs, and began blowing whistles and chanting Bush lies, Bush kills, with a AIDS-related message, drop the debt for African countries. It was a quick, effective protest. They were set upon by the young Republicans, who really moved in quickly, holding up signs to sort of cover what was happening. A number of the delegates were, you know, there was certainly jostling, pushing. It was a pretty scary situation. I think I would suggest this is one of the few times where the entry of the Secret Service and the police might actually have been to the advantage of the protesters, because those young Republicans were angry. I think they saw these folks as sort of like junior league Michael Moores, and they were all over them. You know, there's been some reports that the protesters attacked delegates. Everything I've seen from the film afterwards, reports, people who were actually down there, says there was no attack on the delegates. These were very direct, traditional protesters who just simply wanted to get a message out.
Firthap Chatterjee, you've been following Dick Cheney for quite a while, and particularly looking at Halliburton through Corp Watch and your reporting on corporations. Talk about what you think is most significant here.
Well, I think in listening to his speech and reading it later, I mean, this sort of reveals a deeply paranoid man, as John said, you know, obsessed with foreign policy and always has been. And he's clearly, you know, he plays fast and loose with the truth, as he has throughout his history. And, you know, he's Janine Garofalo called him a self-licking ice cream cone yesterday, which I thought was a great image. Mm-hmm. This is somebody who, you know, he starts a war that he himself never would have fought. He's a man who spends our taxes, but never paid his own taxes. And he's
what do you mean by that?
He currently actually gets as much money from Halliburton in a salary as he does that we pay him as vice president. So he gets $198,000 as vice president. He gets between $170,000 and $200,000 a year from Halliburton. And the reason is he deferred his salary so he could take advantage of a tax cut. So he's willing to. He's currently, the Congressional Research Service actually found that he was actually had a conflict of interest because he was still receiving money from a company as vice president. And when he was the head of this company, Halliburton, I mean, he either lied all the time or he's delusional and was doing a bad job. This is a man who says he didn't know creative accounting was taking place. And somebody who directs
an nonprofit, and I don't mean to intervene here, but who actually cut a video for Arthur Anderson saying that they taught me accounting tricks I could never have thought
exactly
of.
So either he's delusional or he's lying. This is a man who says he didn't know about asbestos liability in the year 2000, when we've known about this for 20 years, and it cost the company billions of dollars.
After they bought Dressler Industries.
Dressler Industries. Mm-hmm. He didn't know about Dressler's activities in Iraq. He said categorically, we are not doing business in Iraq. And when presented with the evidence, he said, well, he didn't know about it. And it's the same thing.
But he was head of the company that was doing the business.
He was the chief executive officer at the time when they were doing business in Iraq as part of the All for Food program.
The Halliburton issue has been out there now. Many Americans know about it, but to what degree has it become, in the minds of many Americans, the scandal that many of us think it is?
There's a quote I actually want to read to you guys from a report that we did called Houston, We Have a Problem, about this company. I don't know if you've heard this. The quote basically is about Halliburton's war profiteering during Vietnam. The quote is, why this huge contract has not been and is now not being adequately audited is beyond me. The potential for waste and profiteering under such a contract is substantial. And the speaker, a young member of the House of Representatives by the name of Donald Rumsfeld in 1966. Mm-hmm. So this is a company that has been attacked correctly for its war profiteering, for its waste at the time. You know, they couldn't produce $120 million worth of receipts. Exactly the same story today. Mm-hmm. This is a company that has had contracts up the wazoo that they should never have gotten because they designed them themselves. Just like Dick Cheney is the man who's put in charge of selecting a vice president and appointed himself, Kellogg, Brown & Root, Halliburton was asked to design a contract in for privatizing the military and then gave it to them and then got it themselves.
And if I could just add on this, because this is a really important fact, which you've done so much good work on.
We have 10 seconds to end.
And that is that it was Dick Cheney who, as Secretary of Defense, had Kellogg, Brown & Root write the plan for privatization of war. And what you're seeing in Iraq today is a direct result of what Dick Cheney did as Secretary of Defense back in 1991-92.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. John Nichols, Nation Magazine and the Madison Capital Times. His new book is called Dick, the Man Who Was President, and Prothap Chatterjee of CorpWatch.org. That does it for this show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Rick Rowley, Alpa Patel, Nell Geiser. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. DemocracyNow.org. Thanks for joining us.